tent. He ran forward anyway, a half mile, a mile. He had no idea of either time or space now. A paralyzing thought struck at him and suddenly held David Hudson tight as the final grip of death. They weren't even chasing him. They weren't even giving chase back into the jungle. Hudson continued running, falling, picking himself up, falling, picking himself up, falling, picking himself up. Then it was so dark there was nothing left in the world. Hudson kept running, falling, picking himself up, falling, picking himself up, falling, falling, falling. A song from the Doors played in his head. Fourth latitude, then nothing at all. Hudson woke with a nightmarish jolt. A silent scream never made it out of his tight, dry larynx. Long grass was stuck to one side of his face. Sticky, gummy tears had formed in his half-closed eyes. Fat black flies had attached themselves to his lips and nostrils. Hundreds of black flies were plastered all over his body. Trying to right himself, he nearly laughed out loud. It was exactly as he'd always believed this putrid affair called life to be. Resolutely unfair, pointless in the end, and in the beginning, and in the middle, too. Anyone with any reason could see the absurd eternal pattern. David Hudson fell away into the unrelenting darkness once again. Fourth latitudes played again. Why that fucking song now? He woke again, wildly confused, unnaturally alert. He had to concentrate everything, every trace of energy he had now. He wrestled with himself to stay awake, to hold on to a thin, sane lifeline. Tormenting waves, disconnected images and thoughts kept coming. Ghosts, just beyond his full comprehension. Raging rivers of shadowy, half-formed images, words, hellish fantasy shapes. Almost a psychedelic experience, as if he'd been smoking the strongest Thai sticks. Shooting skag. This was so horrible, too much for anyone to take much longer. What happened to him then? What did it feel like when you cracked wide open? The severe gagging stopped as soon as he wasn't thinking about it. Hudson began to scream. He was swimming toward some kind of release. Eternity was rushing forward, leaping at him in the form of a sea of leeches, screeching, clawing monkeys, indistinct, shadowy, jungle insects and reptiles. He screamed for hours without end. Then the prison camp guards came. So suddenly, they were there, on him, everywhere. Busy hands were scrabbling, poking, reaching all over his body. Hot hands were probing, continually poking him. Blood roared in the funnels of Hudson's ears. The vicious leeches were crawling all over him, too. Sharp little leech stings. Strong hands were lifting him, then whispering, almost cruel voices. There were no distinct, recognizable words. Leave me alone. Leave me alone. Hudson was pinioned down and helpless. Please leave me alone. Something large and jet black, a huge, flapping bird grabbed onto his face. It smelled like burning rubber, even worse than that. It began to crawl all over his face. Get it off me! Get it off me! Please get it off me! A shaft of light suddenly opened. Gleaming, almost beautiful light shone in his deep, dark tunnel of terror. A scream came that seemed very far away. No! It was his own scream. Impossible. Impossible. This was so impossible. Army corpsman was staring down. Army corpsman was staring down. Army corpsman was staring down. Ours. Our corpsman. Chapter 55. Breathe deeply, Captain Hudson. Just breathe now. Just breathe. Breathe. There, that's good. That's very good. That's excellent, Captain Hudson. It's pure oxygen, Captain. Oxygen. Don't think right now. Breathe. Breathe. Breathe deeply. White cloth straps were holding him tightly, painfully so. Blue and red plastic tubes ran in and out of his nose. More tubes were connected to his arms and legs. Colored wires, rubber plugs were attached to his chest, and from there to an icy blue machine. Captain Hudson. Captain, can you hear me? Can you understand me? You're in the Womack Hospital at Fort Bragg, Captain. You're going to be all right. Just fine. Captain, can you understand me? You're in the Womack Hospital. Oh, please help me. He was sobbing uncontrollably for the first time since he'd been a little boy. What was happening? Oh, please. What was this? What was real and what wasn't? Captain, you're in the Fort Bragg Center. You're in the JFK Special Forces Center. Captain Hudson? Captain, just breathe the oxygen. Captain, that's an order. Breathe in. Breathe out. That's very good. Very, very good. That's excellent. Lying on his back, staring silently up at vague forms and swimming shapes, David Hudson thought that maybe he knew this man. How was that? Familiar voice? Familiar drooping blonde walrus mustache. Did he know him? Was the man actually there? Hudson reached forward to touch, but couldn't move because of the cloth strap. Captain Hudson, you're in the Fort Bragg Center for Special Forces. This was a stress and tolerance test. Do you remember now? Captain Hudson, this has been a drug-induced test. You haven't left this room inside the hospital. You were flashing back to Vietnam. Nothing real? None of this happened? No, there had been a Viet Cong prison camp. Hallucinations? There had been a lizard man. Oh, please, make this all stop now. Captain Hudson, you revealed nothing about your mission. You passed your tolerance test. Flying colors. You were really great. Congratulations. Mission? A test? Sure thing. Just a little pop quiz. Okay. You're beginning to understand illusion, Captain. You refuse to be interrogated under drugs. You're learning to be illusion's master. You're learning the fine art of deception, Captain Hudson. The art of our deadliest enemy. Force Latitude was playing somewhere in the hospital. In the Special Forces Center. Deception. Breathe that good air, Captain Hudson. Just breathe in easily. Pure, pure oxygen. You passed, Captain. You're the best so far. You're the best we've tested. Stress and tolerance test. The Womack Hospital at Fort Bragg. Deception. He was learning to be illusion's master. You passed, Captain Hudson. Flying colors. Of course. I'm the best you have. I've always been the best. At everything. That's why I'm here, isn't it? That's why I was chosen for this training. Hallucination. Deception. Important to understand. The key. The solution, the answer to everything was deception. Breathe that pure oxygen, Captain Hudson. Chapter 56. Carol was barely awake, barely functioning. Familiar home surroundings coalesced. Books on the mantel. The Brethren, Fatal Vision, The Pope of Greenwich Village, The Fate of Uri. An oil painting of his father, done by Mary Catherine, hung on one wall. And there were children. Lots and lots of children. They were eyeing him suspiciously, waiting for him to speak, to say something characteristically flip and amazing. Carol slowly sipped fresh-brewed coffee from a cracked Revenge of the Jedi mug. Sunrise Semester flickered on the TV with the sound off. The horizontal line lazily flipped out of sync with the rest of the room. The Carroll clan was together for a rare family conference. Coffee, Coco and Carol's world-famous pop-up toaster French toast comprised the menu. Lizzie was a son of a bitch, Dad, while you were gone away. Mickey Kevin reported this news as he chewed heavily syruped wads of toast, his mouth flapped open in a rubbery, half-smiling circle. I think I told you about that kind of gutter talk. You gutter talk. Yeah, maybe my dad didn't pick my rear end enough. I won't make that same mistake, okay? Besides, I wasn't the son of a bitch. He was. Lizzie suddenly glared up from the soggy remains on her plate. Lizard, you're not too big to get an ivory soap sandwich either. Big bar, right fresh out of the wrapper. The most angelic smile lit up Lizzie's face. An ivory soap sandwich, Daddy? Better than Eggo, still a little frozen French toast. She leveled her father with a deadpan, brutal evaluation of his not entirely home-cooked breakfast offering. They all began to laugh then. Clancy and Mary nearly fell off their chairs, giggling. Mickey Kevin did topple off, like a drunken carnival cutie doll. Carol finally gave up. He broke into a sleepy smile. He winked over at Mary Kay, who was letting him run the familiar four-ring circus this morning. He had been trying to tell them about his almost tragic trip to Europe. He'd been trying to be a reasonably good dad for the four of them. He fuzzily remembered how his own father had done the same sort of thing, telling sanitized stories about the 91st Precinct, right in that very same breakfast nook on Sunday morning. Finally, after putting it off at least 30 minutes, Carol came to the really difficult part of his story, the punchline, so to speak, the core of his tale of adventure and foreign intrigue in England and Ireland. He was going to try and make this all sound very casual now. No big deal, right? So begin. Over in Europe, I was working with someone. They had these special teams of police with financial people, our best people. We worked in London, then in Belfast, together. She was nearly killed there, in fact, over in Ireland. Her name's Caitlin. Her name is Caitlin Dillon. Silence. The big chill comes to the Carroll house. Keep going. Don't stop now. Sometime, I'd like you guys to meet her. No big deal. She's originally, she's from out in Ohio. She's pretty funny, actually. Very nice. For a girl. Absolute, stone cold silence. Finally, a very tiny, muffled reply from Lizzie. No, thank you. Carol's eyes slowly, ever so slowly, passed from face to small face. Mickey, who looked all soft and vulnerable in his Yankee pinstripe PJs with slipper socks, was close to tears. Clancy, in an oversized robe that made him look like E.T. in the fantasy movie's beer-drinking scene, was silent and more stoic. His small body was rigid with control. They were angry and hurt, all at the same time. They knew exactly what was happening here. Hey, come on, lighten up, okay? Carol tried to make it seem a little funny. Bill Murray on Saturday Night Live, which he did pretty well, despite the lack of any facial resemblance. I talked to a woman who I happened to work with. Just talked. Hello, blah, 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 goodbye. They wouldn't say a word to him. They stared at Carol as if he had just said he was going to leave them. They made him feel so bad. So hollow and hopeless about everything, literally everything in his or their life. Come on, it's been 3 years. I'm closing up inside. I'm dying. Come on, kids, Mary Catherine finally spoke up from her low-key spot at the kitchen table. Be a little fair, huh? Doesn't your father get to have some friends, too? Silence. No, he doesn't. Not women friends. Lizzie finally started to cry. She tried to muffle her sobs, choking back the breathless gasps with both little hands. Then they were all crying, except Mickey Kevin, who kept staring murderously at his father. It was Carol's worst moment with them since the night Nora had actually died on some high and mighty antiseptic white floor in New York Hospital. His chest was beginning to heave now, too. His heart felt as if it was being cruelly, brutally ripped in half. They weren't ready for someone else. Maybe he wasn't ready either. For the next several minutes, nothing he could say could make it any better. Nothing could make any of the kids laugh. Nothing could make them loosen up at all. They all hated Caitlin. They weren't going to give her a chance. Period. End of non-discussion. They were fiercely determined to hate anyone who wasn't their dead mother. Chapter 57. 2 hours later in Manhattan, Carol felt that he needed a stiff shot of Irish whiskey. He also felt like going back to the role of Crusader Rabbit, running away into the strangely comfortable fantasy of the bagman. For the first time, maybe, he thought he was beginning to understand the past 3 years of his life. Later that day, he would vaguely remember weaving a mostly aimless path inside No. 13 Wall Street at around 9 o'clock. The fluorescent lights were too bright. The glaring overhead lamps were harsh, tearing at his eyes. It was all wrong. The place felt wrong. There was too much gloom and doom. Frustration was evident everywhere Carol walked. The police investigators, the Wall Street researchers bent over mountainous documents or hunched in paralysis in front of computer screens. They were like people who have been trapped indoors too long, men and women who haven't seen the light of day for weeks. Around 9:30, Arch Carroll set to work again inside his monastic office. Green band. Why did he have the feeling that there was something important on the top of his mind? An obvious insight that had evaded him until now. It was infuriating and elusive, like soap that gets away from your hand in the tub. Like a forgotten name. Was it something to do with Green Band's inside information? A spy at No. 13? But the half-formed thought, whatever it was, had already vanished. From a transcript taken in room 312, No. 13 Wall Street, Monday, December 13th. Present, Arch Carroll, Anthony Ferrano, Michael Caruso. Carroll. Hello, Mr. Ferrano. I'm Mr. Carroll, Antiterrorist Division, State Department. This is my associate, Mr. Caruso. Mr. Ferrano, to get right to the point, not to waste any of your time or mine, I need some information. Ferrano. Figured that out already. Carroll. Uh-huh. Well, I read your earlier transcript. I just read over the conversation you had with Sergeant Caruso. I'm a little surprised you haven't heard anything about the bombings on Wall Street. Ferrano. Why is that? Why should I have? Carol. Well, for one thing, you being a heavy gun and explosive dealer, Mr. Ferrano, doesn't it strike you as odd, peculiar, you wouldn't have heard something? There must be rumors floating around on the street. I'm sorry, would you like a sip of whiskey? Ferrano, I want whiskey. I've got money in my pocket. Listen, I told you. I told somebody, Kim, I don't deal guns. I don't know what you're talking that shit for. I own Playland Arcade Games Incorporated on 10th Avenue and 49th Street. You got that straight now? Carol, okay, that's bullshit. Who do you think you're talking to? Some punk off the street? Just some street punk here? Ferrano, hey, all right, fuck you, I want my lawyer in here now. Hey, you understand English, pal? Lawyer, now. Hey, hey, oh, shit. Loud scuffling, fighting sounds, furniture crashing, man groaning. Carol, breathing heavily. Mr. Ferrano, I feel it's important you understand something. Listen carefully to what I'm saying. Watch my lips, Ferrano. You've just entered the Twilight Zone. You don't have the right to remain silent in the Twilight Zone. All your constitutional rights have been temporarily canceled. You have no lawyer. All right? We set to continue our discussion, fuckhead. Ferrano. Shit, man. My tooth broken. Give me a break for... Ah, shit, man. Carol, I'm trying to give you every break in the world. Don't you understand anything yet? What this is here? What's happening? Somebody stole money from the man. Some very important people are severely pissed off. Big, big people. Why don't you imagine that this is Vietnam and you're the Viet Cong? Would that help you? Toronto, wait a minute. I didn't do anything. Carol, no? You sell pump-action shotguns, revolvers to 14, 15-year-old kids. Black, PR, Chinese kids and gangs. I'm not going to say any more than that. Your lawyer is a Mr. Joseph Rao of 24 Park Avenue. Mr. Rao doesn't want any part of this. I think you better tell me everything you've heard on the street. Ronald, look, I'll tell you what I know. I can't tell you what I don't know. Carol, that I can buy. Ronald, all right, I heard there was some heavy artillery available in the city. This was about beginning, I guess, maybe middle of November. Yeah, 5 weeks ago. Carol, how heavy are we talking about? Toronto, like M-60s, like M-79 rocket launchers, Soviet RPD light machine gun, SKS automatic, that kind of stuff. Heavy. I mean, what the fuck they gonna do with that kind of munition? That's basic ground assault equipment, like in Nam. What you'd use, take over a country. That's all I heard. I'm telling the truth, Carol. Hey, that's all anybody knows on the street. Aw, oh, come on, don't you believe me? Hey, seriously. Carol, tell me what you know about Francois Montserrat. Verano, he ain't Italian. Carol, Mr. Verano, thank you so much for your help. Now get out of my office, please. Miss Caruso will show you to the nearest rat hole out. From a transcript taken in room 312, number 13 Wall Street. Present, Arch Carol. Mohammed Salam. Carol. Hello there, Mr. Salam. Haven't seen you since you had Percy Ellis killed on 103rd Street. Very nice jalaba. Sip of Irish whiskey. Salam. Liquor is against my religious beliefs. Carol. This is Irish whiskey. It's blessed. Well, we'll get right down to official police business then. Tell me, are you a hunter, Mr. Salam? Salam, laugh. No, not really. A hunter? Actually, if you stop to think about it, I'm a huntee. Ever since I fought for you whites in Southeast Asia. My name is Salam, by the way. Carol. Salam. I'm sorry. No, you see, I thought you must be a hunter. Something like that. You see, we found all of these hunting guns, these hunting bombs in your apartment up in Yonkers, M23 squirrel hunting guns, opossum hunting sniper rifles, the ones with star night scopes, chipmunk hunting fragmentation grenades, B-40 duck hunting rockets. Salam. You bust into my place? Carol. Had to. What do you know about Mr. Francois Montserrat? Salam. You had a warrant from a judge? Carol. Well, we couldn't get an official bench warrant. We did talk to a judge off the record. He said, don't get caught. We took it from there. Salam. No search warrant or nothing? Carol. You know, this is really shocking. Didn't anybody read the June 16th Time magazine? Story on me? Little squared off red box thing? Doesn't anybody understand who I am? I'm a terrorist. Just like you guys, I don't play by International Red Cross of Switzerland agreement. Mr. Salam, you sold some M23 squirrel hunting guns, also some quail hunting sniper rifles to a couple of fellas, about 6 weeks ago. Who are they? Long pause. Mr. Salam. Please let me explain something else to you. Explain this as clearly as I can. You're a bright, U.S. college-educated terrorist. You went to Howard University for a year. You did a little time in Attica. You're one of the Mark Rudd, Eldridge Cleaver, Kathy Bodine school. Me, on the other hand, I'm a terrorist of the PLO Red Brigade, blow away anything that moves school. Now then, you sold a full case of stolen M23s on or about November 1st. That's a fact we both know about. You say, yes, I did, or I'll break your right hand. Just say, yes, I did. Salam. Yeah, I did. Carol. Good. Thank you for your forthrightness. Now, who did you sell the M23s to? Wait. Before you answer, remember that I'm the PLO. Don't say anything you'd be afraid to say to a PLO investigator in Beirut. Salam. I don't know who they are. Carol. Oh, Jesus Christ. Salam. No, wait a minute. They knew who I was. They knew everything about me. I never saw anybody, I swear it. I felt like they had set me up. Carol. I love former inmate sincerity. Unfortunately, I happen to believe you, because that's what your current roommate, Mr. Rashad, said too. Please get the hell out of here now. Oh, by the way, Mr. Salam, we had to rent your apartment up in Yonkers. We rented it to a very nice welfare lady with these three little kids. Salam. You did what? Carol. We rented the apartment you were selling guns out of. We rented it to a nice lady with a batch of kids. Skull, brother. Chapter 58. It's also incredibly methodical. That's what is mystifying. They keep evading all contact with this huge police dragnet. How? Caitlin and 83-year-old Anton Birnbaum, both red-eyed and exhausted, sat together on stiff leather Harvard chairs in Birnbaum's lower Wall Street office. Caitlin was 6 inches taller than the bird-like, deceptively frail financier. Earlier in her career, when she had worked for Birnbaum, he wouldn't walk anywhere on Wall Street with her for that reason. Now, Anton Birnbaum rubbed the small of his back as he tossed. Something so very methodical, so carefully orchestrated. Something absolutely systematic is happening throughout Western Europe right now. Caitlin watched Birnbaum's face. She waited for more to come. It usually did with Anton, who thought much faster than he could speak. There is a book, The Real War, it's called. The book's central thesis, that Germany, Japan, have found an eminently reasonable road to further world conquest. Through commerce. That's the real war. As a country, we're losing that war spectacularly, don't you think, Caitlin? The former chairman of the venerable investment house, Birnbaum Levitt, was something of a prig, Caitlin knew. He could be savagely impatient with people he didn't like or respect, but he was also brilliant. What do you think is happening in Western Europe? We're having an impossible time piecing it together, Anton. Some important data is missing. One essential thread of logic that might explain who they are. Caitlin wandered around the old man's office as she talked. She stopped with her back to the window and looked at the photographs on the walls. There was Anton snapped in the company of statesmen, controversial industrialists, people from the entertainment industry. Birnbaum scratched the bridge of his nose as he contemplated his choice of the next few words. He was reminded once again that Caitlin was one of the few people on Wall Street he could talk to. Explanations of his theories and insights were unnecessary when speaking with her. The Europeans simply don't trust us, he finally began again, hunching forward in his seat. Which is precisely why they don't talk to us anymore. They believe we have different attitudes, different priorities. Anton Birnbaum stared directly into Caitlin's brown eyes. His own eyes were watering hopelessly behind thick lenses. He reminded Caitlin of a character in Wind in the Willows, Mr. Mole. I sound like an alarmist, no? But I feel the intrinsic truth of what I'm saying. Almost prima facie. I feel it. There will be a crash now. I believe there will be a serious crash. Possibly another Black Friday. Very, very soon. Anton Birnbaum spoke again. I think we could be in the middle of a war. The money war. The great Third World War we have so long feared. It may already be upon us. Chapter 59. God damn it, look at this. The speaker was Walter Trentkamp, and his voice was harsh with disbelief. Gentlemen, it's happening everywhere. Philip Berger, director of the CIA, Trentkamp, and General Frederick House were gathered around the computer terminals when Caitlin and Carol arrived. Several display screens were working simultaneously, flashing words as well as graphics. Berger glanced up at Caitlin Dillon, and Carol hurried across the crisis room floor. He frowned. Emergency reports have been coming in for about 15-20 minutes, he said to the others. Since 3:30 our time. They've got something hopping. Something's happening all over the world this time. At 1 o'clock Paris time, La Compagnie des Agents was suddenly closed by official order of the President of France. All stock trading was immediately halted on the bourse. Bourse officials reluctantly admitted that the market's CAC index had fallen over 3% in a single morning. The afternoon newspapers in Paris carried the most shocking headline in four decades. Market close to panic. Bourse crash. Paris market in shambles. Financial disaster. For once, the tabloids were being ridden with some understatement, however. The Frankfurt Stock Exchange was in chaos, but still managed to stay open for the entire session. The Commerzbank index had fallen under 1,000 for the first time since back in 1982. The largest losers for the day included Westdeutsche Landesbank, Bayer, Volkswagen, and Philipp Holzmann. As yet, none of the economists in West Germany understood why prices were dropping or how far they might plummet in the near future. The Toronto Stock Exchange was one of the worst hit anywhere. The exchange's composite index of 300 stocks fell 155 points to under 2,000. Trading volumes set new records until the major Canadian exchange was officially closed at 1 p.m. In Tokyo, the Nikkei Dow Jones Index was shaky all day, finally closing at 9,200. This was a full 2.5% decline in a single day. Hardest hit were all companies trading heavily with the Middle East. These included Mitsui Petrochemical, Sumitomo Chemical, Oki Electric. Heavy European and American deposits made the Johannesburg Stock Exchange the only apparent winner anywhere around the world. Bullion was suddenly trading at $1,000 an ounce. The rand instantly appreciated to $1.50. Hundreds of millions of dollars were made in South Africa. Suspicions rose, but still no satisfactory answers came. London dramatically shut down at 12 noon, 3.5 hours shy of regular closing. The Financial Times index of 750 companies had fallen nearly 90 points. It was down almost 200 since the initial green band bombings in New York. The scene on Threadneedle, near the Bank of London, was nearly as bleak and without hope as bombed-out Wall Street in New York. With its 40-button telephone computer consoles, the crisis room at No. 13 Wall was beginning to resemble the Starship Enterprise more than the traditional Chippendale feel and look of the street. Nonetheless, the 30 or so police, army, and financial experts in the room had absolutely no idea what they were supposed to accomplish next. The Western economic system seemed to be crashing to a disastrous halt. Not one of them had a reasonable clue why. And still, there was only maddening silence from green bands. Chapter 60. Carol and Caitlin Dillon sat on an old floral couch in his Manhattan apartment. A Beethoven concerto played on the tape deck. Once again, they were waiting for Green Band. There was nothing to do but wait. "I think I have to turn in," Caitlin finally said in a half-asleep whisper. She hunched forward and kissed Carol's forehead. "Get a few hours anyway." Carol raised his wristwatch to his face. "What a party pooper. No sense of adventure. It's only 2:30. People from Ohio go to bed at 9:30, 10 o'clock. The Lima Holiday Inn restaurant is filled at 5:30, closed down by 8. "Yeah, but you're a sophisticated New Yorker now. We party until 2 or 3 on weekdays here." Caitlin kissed Carol again, and the idle talk stopped. She was amazed at how comfortable he was with her. Watching someone you cared about almost being killed seemed to accelerate the courting process. "Is anything the matter? You look sad. Tell me." Her eyes were digging for more to understand who Carol really was. "I'm not quite ready for bed yet. I'm overtired, I guess. I'll be in soon. You go ahead." Caitlin leaned in closer and kissed Carol again. She smelled so wholesome and nice. She had the softest lips he could imagine. "You want me to stay with you?" she whispered one more time. Carol shook his head. Caitlin left the living room, sleepily huddled in the cocoon of a blanket. Carol stood up from the couch. He started to pace back and forth past the darkly reflective parlor windows. His body was feeling all wrong. Wired. Incandescent. He looked inside an old antique blanket chest he'd bought years back in central Pennsylvania. His mind was wandering into odd places, weird time zones. He wondered if Caitlin liked kids much. Jesus, he was so incredibly wired, so uptight tonight. Finally, he did it, though. The worst thing under the circumstances, the absolute worst. On the anniversary, Nora's death 3 years before, December 14th. First, Carol gathered together old photographs. He found most of the photos on a cluttered bottom shelf inside a glass-enclosed book cabinet. Next, he pulled a wicker chair up close beside one of the tall windows facing onto the lights of Riverside Drive and the river. Carol stared down at the West Side Highway, the peacefully quiet boat basin. He was letting the present go all fuzzy and blurred. He stood up again. He dealt 3 tapes off the stacks on either side of the stereo. One was 52nd Street, Billy Joel self-consciously holding a trumpet on the cover. The second was mainstream country and western, I Believe in Love by somebody called Don Williams. The third was Barbara Streisand and Barry Gibb's Guilty. Carol switched on the stereo and the speakers immediately hummed. He felt the power surge through the soles of his bare feet. He turned the volume way down. He'd never been a big Barbara Streisand fan, but there were 2 songs he wanted to hear on this album, Woman in Love and Promises. Out in the world, a moving van rumbled along Riverside Drive. He kept an old framed picture of Nora hidden away face down in the bottom of the bookcase. He slid it out now. He propped the photo on the arm of the couch. For a long, pensive moment, he stared at Nora sitting there in a hospital-issue wheelchair. Anniversary of her death. Pain still sharp and fresh as yesterday. He could remember exactly when the snapshot had been taken. After they'd operated. After the surgeons had failed to remove her malignant tumor. In the wheelchair photo, Nora was wearing a simple yellow-flowered sundress, a knitted blue cardigan sweater. She had on a pair of crazy high-top sneakers which became her trademark as an invalid. Nora was smiling radiantly in the picture. Not once, to his knowledge, had she completely broken down during the illness. Not once had she felt sorry for herself. She'd been 31 years old when they found the tumor. She'd had to watch her blonde hair fall out from the chemotherapy treatment. Then she'd had to adapt to life in the iron clutches of her wheelchair. Nora had somehow accepted that she wasn't going to see her children grow up, or anything else the two of them had laughed and dreamed about, and always taken for granted. Why couldn't he finally accept her death? Why couldn't he ever accept the way life was apparently supposed to be? Arch Carroll stopped and listened closely to Barbara Streisand singing. The song, Promises, made him remember the stretch when he'd visited Nora every night, night after night at New York Hospital. After the hospital visits, Carroll would eat at Galahanti's Bar up the hill on First Avenue. A burger, soggy home fries, draft beer that tasted the way swamp gas smelled. The beginning of his drinking problem. The two Streisand songs had been favorites on Galahanti's jukebox. They always made him think of Nora, all alone back at that scary skyscraper hospital. Sitting in the bar, he always wanted to go back at 10, 11 o'clock to talk with her just a little bit more, to sleep with her, to hold Nora tight against the gathering night inside her New York hospital room, to squeeze every possible moment out of the time they had left together. The worst, the very truest line for him in Promises finally came. Tears slowly rolled down his cheek. The pain inside was like a rock-solid column that extended from the center of his chest all the way into his forehead. The sadness, the inconsolable grief was for Nora, though not for himself. The unfairness of what had happened to her. Carroll began to hold himself fiercely tight, squeezing hard with both arms. When would this feeling please stop? The past 3 years had been unbearable. When would it please fucking stop? He always had the insane urge to break glass. Just to punch out glass. Caitlin, meanwhile, stood immobile, perfectly silent in the darkened apartment hallway. She couldn't catch hold of her breath, couldn't even swallow right then. She had wandered back from the bedroom when she'd heard noises, faint strains of music. She'd found Carroll like this. So sad to watch. She walked back to the bedroom. She huddled deep down into the body-warm covers and sheets. Lying there alone, Caitlin bit down hard on her lower lip. She understood and felt so much more about Carroll, clearly, in an instant. Maybe she understood more than she wanted to. She wanted to hold him right now, only she was afraid to go and ask. Caitlin was afraid to intrude. She didn't know how long she'd been alone in the big silent bedroom overlooking the river. The phone on the bedstand began to ring. It was 3:30. He didn't pick up outside. Where was Carroll now? She waited. 4, 5 rings, and he still didn't pick up. Caitlin finally grabbed for the receiver. A very excited voice was on the phone line. A man was talking before she had a chance to say a word. Arch, sorry to wake you. This is Walter Trenkamp. I'm down at number 13 right now. The stock exchange in Sydney just opened. There's a massive panic. You'd better come now. It's all going to crash. Chapter 61. What's happening, Arch? I think there's a disorderly, almost a riotous market condition. Everybody desperately wants to sell. Except there's a corresponding lack of buyers, Caitlin said. What exactly does that mean? Carroll asked. It means the bottom line price of stocks and bonds has to plummet dramatically. The crash that's apparently coming could last a few hours, days, or drag on for years. Years? Back in 63, on the day Kennedy was assassinated, the market collapsed and was shut down early. The next day it recovered. But it wasn't until after World War II that the market recovered from the crash of 1929. Carroll and Caitlin Dillon were hurrying across the immense marble lobby of the World Trade Center. It was here, on the ground floor and mezzanine, that the fiduciary nerve center of the banks and trust companies had been established after the bombings on Wall Street. The escalator stairs to the mezzanine were frozen to a stop. An impromptu sign over a red arrow said, Financial section, and pointed straight up. Carroll and Caitlin started to jog up the oddly motionless metal stairs. It was just past 4 a.m. This looks a little more organized than number 13. Not much, though, Carol observed. Red and blue intercom wires were strung up everywhere, hung like Christmas decorations over the escalators and fire exit stairways. Open radio channels connecting uptown offices with the financial center squawked and chattered endlessly. Even at that time in the morning, the hum and buzz of electronic noise was unrelenting. Out a row of high, vaulted windows, Carol and Caitlin could see a Black Bell Army helicopter landing. Limos and other official cars were discharging somber-looking men carrying business briefcases. A crash coming this morning? Another Black Friday? What happened? What's causing the worldwide panic? Carol wanted to know as he and Caitlin entered a cavernous marble hallway with no visible way out. Caitlin rubbed her arms warm as she walked. The glass doors to the outside were constantly opening, and the building was cold as a meat freezer. None of the usual safeguards in the systems are working. Not enough fail-safe devices were ever built in for a situation like this. Academic economists have been warning the New York Stock Exchange for years. Every MBA candidate in the country knows that something like this could happen. Carol finally pushed open heavy pine doors into a huge, disturbingly frantic business conference room, a miniature stock exchange almost. Brokers on complex, NYTEC telephone consoles, analysts with IBM desktop computers were talking all at once. The room was absolutely jammed with frenetic, shadowy figures, many of whom were shouting into phone receivers which they managed to cradle in a practiced defiance of gravity between jaw and shoulder. Carol had the impression of madness, a bedlam. What this place reminded him of, give or take some modern accoutrement, was a print he'd once seen of a Massachusetts insane asylum in the late 1800s. Unconditional orders were being issued to sell at the very best price possible. Jobs and business relationships were being routinely threatened over the long-distance telephones. Jay Fairchild, tall, jowly, bald as an infant, lumbered forward out of a clique of gray suits to meet Caitlin and Carol. Fairchild was an undersecretary of the Treasury, a man who'd come to rely regularly on Caitlin's judgment, her usually astute, almost uncanny hunches about the market. Jay, what the hell has happened tonight? Who started it? Where did it start? It was Caitlin's turn to appear confused for a change. The Undersecretary of the Treasury's eyes had the animation of glass beads. Just about every nightmare scenario you or I have ever imagined has come true tonight, Fairchild finally said. At the end of the day yesterday, out in Chicago, metal skyrocketed way up. A ton of futures, coffee, sugar, flopped badly. Bank of America and First National began calling in their loans. Caitlin couldn't hold back her anger at that news. Those unbelievable shifts. Morons. The commodity people out of Chicago won't listen to anybody, Arch. There have been all sorts of speculative excesses on the options market long before this. None of that is the real problem right now, though, Jay Fairchild said. The crash is being precipitated by the goddamn bank. The banks are almost completely responsible. Let's wander back to the lobby. You'll see what I mean. It's worse than it looks up here. It's quite sad, really. Chapter 62. FBI agents and hard-nosed-looking New York City police officers were screening the credentials of everyone trying to get into the conference room on the ground floor level. Carol knew the FBI guys, so they walked right in. Once inside, the thundering noise and activity was double what Carol and Caitlin had witnessed and heard upstairs. It was still only 4:30 a.m., but a nightmarish fear had taken firm hold. You could see it on every face inside the overcrowded room. There's another factor contributing to the current disaster, Jay Fairchild said. The real possibility of a worldwide crash, rather than an isolated one in the U.S. This time, the whole bloody world could go up. Everyone they passed in the conference room appeared hopelessly grave. The scene was something like a general alarm on a Navy warship. Caitlin said, 7 days of brokerage transactions are now unresolved. The bankers are competing. They're actually competing to see who can take the most clear-cut, absolutely immoral advantage of the chaos. Carol didn't understand some of what was being said, but he grasped enough. When you misappropriate people's money, a lot of small investors' money given to you on trust, he figured you were a criminal. Call him naive and old-fashioned, but that was how he felt. It sounds to me like nobody's protecting the ordinary investor right now. Jay Fairchild nodded. Nobody is. The big banks are all busy maneuvering for the oil billion. They could give a damn about the poor bastard out there with 100 shares of Polaroid or AT&T. Arch, Arab oil money is the name of the game. Arab money is almost always conservatively managed. Since last Friday, they've been trying to move out of the U.S. Treasury bill, into gold, into other precious metals. The banks are shamelessly scrambling for the huge Arab fees. They're like rats on a ship, bailing out of the dollar, rushing into sterling, the yen, the Swiss franc, all the more stable currencies. Chase, manufacturers, Bank of America, they're making small fortunes right now. Caitlin's lips were tight and her jaw clenched as she spoke. The three of them stood by helplessly watching the stock market crash gain a momentum of its own. Reports from London, Paris, Bonn, and Geneva came rushing in. Men in white shirt sleeves and loosened neckties took turns calling out the more substantial telex quotes for the benefit of beleaguered clerks who reported them into a massive central computer. Fibro Solomon bought at 12.5, down 22. General Electric bought at 35, down 31. IBM bought at 80.5, down 40. By 11:30 on the morning of December 14th, most U.S. banks, including every savings and loan, had been closed. The Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, Pacific, and Midwest exchanges had all been officially shut down. Chapter 63. At noon, an elderly man made his way toward the hub of action at the front of the World Trade Center crisis room. Many of the young brokers and bankers didn't recognize Anton Birnbaum. Those who did regarded him with sharp, uneasy glances. Birnbaum looked more like an ancient New York City pawnbroker than one of the world's acknowledged financial geniuses, a man with a reputation that had been unblemished over all his years in business. President Justin Kearney had arrived by helicopter from Washington less than 30 minutes before. The president warmly greeted the financier, speaking with deference and respect. It's awfully good to see you again, Anton, especially now. The president spoke formally, as he might to a visiting foreign dignitary. Kearney and Anton Birnbaum disappeared inside a small private office, the door of which was guarded by the Secret Service. It's good to be seen out in the world, Mr. President. I don't get out so much anymore. Mr. President, if I might be allowed to speak first, I have an idea you might wish to consider. I have just gotten off the phone with two gentlemen you've possibly never heard of. It's worth repeating both conversations. One man is from Milwaukee, a Mr. Clyde Miller. The other man resides in Nashville, Tennessee, Mr. Louis Levine. Anton Birnbaum said all this in a slow, deliberate style which made each word seem vitally important. Mr. Miller is the CEO for a large brewing company. Mr. Levine is treasurer for the state of Tennessee. I have just convinced Mr. Miller to buy 500,000 shares of General Motors stock, which is right now at 47. He will buy the General Motors stock and keep buying it until the price goes back to 67. He is prepared to invest up to $200 million. I've asked Mr. Louis Levine in Tennessee to buy NCR stock, which is now at 19, and continue to buy it until the price moves up to 30. He's prepared to commit up to $75 million for the purchase. Birnbaum then went on to explain to the president why the plan he conceived could work. I only hope that the courage of these two gentlemen will actually turn the direction of this catastrophe. I pray it will restore some necessary optimism. Mr. President, I have a belief that it will, once the market sniffs the demand for these two bellwether issues, smart money will start moving. The risk arbitragers who can spot an uptrend in an avalanche and who command billions in ready cash will begin testing the waters. I have advised the select few of my associates who have responsibility for mutual and pension funds around the country that a dramatic break in the crisis situation is imminent. I have suggested that they look for opportunities to begin bargain hunting before they lose out on a very fast and favorable profit spiral, a spiral back close to where the market began this morning. The news of Birnbaum's recovery plan traveled with appropriate dispatch through the main Trade Center conference room. Emotional arguments over whether the daring strategy was right or disastrous raged immediately. Clyde Miller has just bankrupted his own corporation. One of the detractors laughed with derision at the news. Two other middle-aged bankers argued their way into a fistfight. Creaking haymakers were thrown. A loop of bankers and stock analysts surrounded the breathless, wheezing fugitive, and a couple of side bets were laid. The fight ended with both bankers leaning against each other in fatigue, as if they were each trying to shore up the other's dignity. As the winter morning passed into steely gray afternoon, however, it was obvious that the Birnbaum plan was either too late or too little. The largest single-day losses ever had already been recorded on the world stock markets. On October 29, 1929, losses had been $14 billion. On December 14, the single day's recorded losses around the world exceeded $200 billion. Chapter 64. Late that night, Caitlin swallowed warm sips of diet soda and sat entranced before a 40-inch television screen just off the main crisis room. The monitor's reception was crisp, the antennas for the major national networks all being up on the Trade Center roof. "This is it," she whispered to Carol. "The exchange in Hong Kong will be the first important one to open around the world. Sydney and Tokyo are both staying closed until noon. Yesterday, the Hang Seng Index fell 80 points. This will tell the story." Caitlin and Carol were sitting within a tightly clustered nest of Wall Street bankers, frayed men and women who were like spectators burned out by watching some unlikely sport event that stretched day after day. A closed-circuit TV broadcast was being beamed by satellite transmission from Asia to New York. On the flickering screen, they watched cameramen and news reporters live recording history from behind Hong Kong police lines. Farther down the crowded, rowdy street, tens of thousands of Hong Kong residents were loudly chanting, waving hand-printed political placards. Meanwhile, single lines of dark-suited stockbrokers were beginning to solemnly march into the exchange itself. "The brokers look like pallbearers," Carol whispered to Caitlin. "It isn't a cheery sight, is it? It does look like a state funeral." A correspondent for one of the American networks stepped up to a TV camera planted on the mob Hong Kong street. The newsman wore a rumpled seersucker suit and spoke with a clipped British accent. "Never before have we seen such a graphic demonstration of a polarization between Third World and Western hopes and dreams. Here in Hong Kong, I believe we are seeing a mini-drama of the imminent future of the world. It is now the day after stock prices have tumbled precipitously everywhere. The bond market is in shambles. The French and Arabs are liquidating their holdings at literally the rate of billions a day. And in Hong Kong this morning, many people are deeply concerned, even sad-faced. But the majority, surprisingly large numbers, mostly university and street gang youths, but also the unemployed, are shouting anti-U.S. slogans, even praying for a shattering stock market crash. The people are rooting for a full-scale world economic crash. They're expecting the worst, and they're gleeful about the disastrous outcome, the long-awaited fall of the West." Chapter 65. Suddenly, everything changed. Unbelievably. Almost as if it had all been prearranged, too. Not 40 minutes after the Hong Kong exchange opened, stock prices on the Hang Seng began to stabilize. Then stock prices started to actually rise, to surge upward on the index. To the disappointment of many of the university students and workers mobbing the streets outside, a dizzying spiral of nearly 75 points followed in the next hour. The exchange in Sydney opened in much the same manner. Grim and hopelessly exhausted brokers at first, highly organized labor and student rallies against capitalism, against the United States in particular, then a burst of excited buying. The same scenario followed at the late opening exchange in Tokyo. In Malaysia, an hour later. Everywhere. Carefully orchestrated chaos. The manipulator's manipulation. But to what end? At 8:30 a.m. New York time, looking as though he'd been liberated from the dustiest carrel in the New York Public Library, Anton Birnbaum peered inside the World Trade Center emergency meeting area. This time, however, a boisterous entourage surged forward and escorted the financier to the front of the pandemonious room. President Kearney appeared relaxed, almost jovial, as he met the aging mastermind. Vice President Thomas Elliott was standing beside him, looking controlled and restrained. The vice president appeared to be the coolest of the Washington leaders. Birnbaum himself seemed astonished by the general hubbub, the strange celebration before 9 in the morning. He was equally astonished by the way the market, like some whimsical thing subject not to the rules of money, but rather the patterns of the wind, had come back so strongly. Mr. Birnbaum, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Mr. President, Mr. Vice President. And I hear it is a pretty good morning. By God, you did it. By God, or in spite of him, Mr. President. This is amazing. It's quite moving, actually. See? Real tears.
Caitlin stood hanging lightly onto Carol's arm. She finally dabbed at her eyes and was hardly alone in the gesture. They were at the heart of the celebration inside the World Trade Center. Off to one side of the room, President Kearney was emotionally clutching his chief of staff. The secretaries of Treasury, State, and Defense were boyish with their loud whoops, their echoing hand clapping. The gray-suited chairman of the Federal Reserve danced briefly with the cantankerous chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
I don't believe I've ever seen bankers so joyous before, Caitlin said.
They still dance like bankers, though. Carol smiled at the odd but affecting scene of relief. He couldn't help feeling elation in the midst of this crazy, almost riotous room, though. It wasn't as if they'd actually found Green Band, but it was something, a sliver of merriment at the heart of the recent grimness, the frustration trailing back for days. Caitlin nuzzled the side of his face with her mouth.
I'm already getting worried again. I only hope.
What do you hope? Carol gently held Caitlin's arm. He felt unbelievably close to her. They had already shared more charged moments than some people do in a lifetime.
I hope that it continues like this and doesn't come crashing down.
Carol was silent, studying the oddly uplifting scene in front of him. Somebody had found a tape player and the sound of Scottish bagpipers could be heard over the general din. Somebody was dragging in a couple of cases of champagne. There was something just a little forced in the celebration.
But what the hell?
These were people who'd been about to fall off the edge of their world and, slippery though it might be, they'd found temporary footing.
Still.
Even as Carol sipped champagne, something inside kept him from getting too hopeful.
This is all premature, he was thinking as the party heightened in intensity.
Where is Green Band? Is Green Band watching right now?
What are they thinking?
Where are they taking us next?
What kind of party are they having today?
Chapter 66. Carol had decided to start at the beginning,
square one again. He thoroughly checked and rechecked every early lead, every hunch he'd ever had about Green Van. The task would take countless hours, he knew. It would require an intense search through the computers, even allowing for the fact that he had high-speed data at his disposal. Ah, police work. He asked for clearance from both the CIA and the FBI to make a search of their computer files. Neither organization gave him trouble, although Phil Berger imposed limitations on Carol's access. Nearly 11 hours later, Carol stood before a dozen or so computer screens inside the emergency room at number 13 wall. Carol stared at the screens and his eyes ached from the dull green glow. He glanced at Caitlin, who sat with her fingers raised over a computer keyboard, ready to type out a password for further access to the FBI's files. When the display screen answered, she typed again, this time requesting a readout of active and non-active Vietnam veterans who, for whatever reason, had been under police surveillance during the past 2 years, a time frame she and Carol had agreed on. She added the subcategory, explosive experts, New York and vicinity, possible subversive leaning. There was a long pause, a spooky electronic pause. Then the machine began its requested readout of American soldiers. Carol had been down this particular route of investigation, only not with the crisis room equipment and Caitlin's help. American terrorist-related groups were out there, but none were considered powerful or well-organized. Phil Berger, of the CIA, had been investigating paramilitary groups himself. He had waved Carol off that trail. Can you print out a list of the hard cases? Carol asked Caitlin. This is a computer. It can do anything if you ask nicely. The printer obligingly kicked back into life. Paper slid through it as the dot matrix clacked back and forward. A total count showed no more than 90 names of current soldiers and veterans with extensive explosive experience in Vietnam, men who the FBI considered important enough to keep track of. Carol ripped the scroll of paper from the printer and took it to a desk, spreading the thing out. Adamski, Stanley, Corporal, 3 years VA hospital, Prescott, Arizona, member of left-wing oriented veterans group called the RAM, ostensibly a biker's club. Carol wondered how much of this was standard FBI paranoia. The list was filled with dizzying cross-references, he soon discovered. One name was connected to another, creating a maze-like effect. You could spend months working on all the permutations. Caresti, John, Sergeant, Munitions Expert, discharged to VA Hospital, Scranton, Pennsylvania, 1974. Occupation, Custodian, Plastics Corporation. Member of the American Socialist Party, Bridgewood, New Jersey. C. Reinhardt, J.T., Jones, James, Winston Files. The list went on and on for pages. Carol massaged his eyelids. He went for two coffees, returned to the work desk and even more sprawling computer sheet. He said, any one of these men, or two or three of them working in tandem, could have helped blow up the financial district. Caitlin gazed over his shoulder at the printout list. So where do we start? Carol shook his head. He was filled with doubts again. They would have to investigate, maybe even visit every name on the list. They didn't have time. Scully, Richard P., Sergeant, Plastique Expert, hospitalized Manhattan, 1974 for alcoholism, extreme right-wing sympathizer, occupation, cab driver, New York City. Downey, Mark, military assassin, hospitalized 1971-73. Occupation, bartender, Worcester, Massachusetts. Carol gazed at the burgeoning list again. He had another idea. An army officer, maybe? A disaffected officer with a grudge or a cause? Somebody exceptionally smart, nursing a grievance, year after year. Carol laid his hands on the warm computer console. He wished he could coax all the secrets out of it, all the electronic length of which it was capable. He stared at the already lengthy printout again. "An officer," Carol said. "Try that." Caitlin went back to the keyboard to request more information. He watched her fingers move expertly over the keys. She was requesting information on known or suspected subversives who had been officers in Vietnam. Under the general rubric of subversive were included all kinds of people. The screen began to issue more names, colonels, captains, majors. Some were listed in these official records as schizophrenic. Others were supposedly burnt out on drugs. Others still had become evangelists, panhandlers, small-time bank and liquor store robbers. Carol received a printout of these names as well. There were 29 of the hardcore category in and around New York City. The screen flickered again. Names of the various officers on the FBI list now shimmered forth. Carol once again ran his eye over them. Bradshaw, Michael. Captain, discharged VA Hospital, Dallas, Texas, 1971. Occupation, real estate salesman, Hempstead, Long Island. Post-traumatic stress disorder victim. Babershill, Terrence, Major, discharged dishonorably, 1969. Known Viet Cong sympathizer. Occupation, English language tutor for various Vietnamese families, Brooklyn, New York. Carol blinked and tried to focus. His eyes were beginning to water. He needed to feel the fresh, cold night air on his face. He didn't move. He continued to run his eyes up and down the screen. Reitholm, Ralph, Colonel. O'Donnell, Joseph, Colonel. Schweitzer, Peter, Lieutenant Colonel. Shaw, Robert, Captain. Norseworthy, Robert, Colonel. Boudreau, Dan, Captain. Kaplan, Lynn, Captain. Weinschenker, Greg, Captain. Dwyer, James, Colonel. Beauregard, Bo, Captain. Arnold, Tim, Captain. Morrissey, Jack, Colonel. Too many names, Carol thought. Too many casualties in a war of total waste. Can you get any cross-references, Caitlin? Associations and connections between any of these men, the officers, the real hard asses out of Vietnam? I'll try. Caitlin tapped a few keys. Nothing happened this time. She stared at the screen.